I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are women in the Canadian Armed Forces. In particular, service women in the post-Second World War period, where women had served successfully during the Second World War in the Canadian Army Women's Corps, as well as similar units in the Air Force and roles in the Navy. In the post-war period, it was a different environment in which the armed forces in Canada were contracting. The Navy, Air Force, and Army all shrank after the Second World War, and the place of women within these institutions started to change in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And there was great debate over the role of women across the Canadian military, and that is the subject of the Shannon Lecture Series on Monday night, September the 22nd at 7 p.m. at Dominion Chalmers Center here in Ottawa, where the speaker will be Sarah Hogenberg, who is a historian specializing in gender history, war and society, and Canadian history generally. And her talk will be entitled Fighting for Their Place and Recognition, Canadian Servicewomen and Women Veterans in Post-Second World War Canada, in which she will talk about this period, talk about the debates that were going on across the Canadian forces, as well as the work of women themselves, both women in the forces and veteran women who were advocating for change. And I should note, too, that this event on Monday will serve as a book launch for a wonderful new edited collection entitled Cold War Workers, Labor, Family, and Community in a Nuclear State, which is edited by Isabel Campbell. And Sarah has a chapter in the book entitled Constructing the Military Career Woman, 1950s, 1960s. And the material from that will form a lot of what that lecture is on Monday. So in advance of that talk, I had the opportunity to talk with Sarah a little bit about her research, the subject of her chapter in Cold War Workers, and a little bit about what she's going to be talking about this upcoming Monday, just to serve as a bit of an appetizer for what should be a wonderful evening here on the 22nd of September. So without any further ado, let's get right to my chat with Sarah Hogenberg. And Sarah Hogenberg joins me now. Sarah, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Doing very well. Looking forward to the Shannon Lecture, which is coming up next Monday, September the 22nd at 7 p.m. Before we get into some of the specifics of what you're going to be talking about, the lecture, as well as your chapter in Cold War Workers, let's just get a little bit of your background. You mentioned before we started to record, some of this work comes out of your dissertation. So what is your primary focus as a historian? What is the area of research that you really focused on during your graduate work?
So I am a gender historian and historian of war and society. So those are the intersections I work, and a Canadian 20th century historian. So my dissertation looked at how military service became a career option for women. So it started just before the Second World War and went up to 1966, when they finally made the decision that, yes, women had a permanent place in the Defense Forces of Canada, and essentially decided that we should really stop asking this question. So up until that point, from 1938 to 1965-66, they would constantly, every year, every few years, ask the question and debate, should women be in the Defense Forces of Canada? And so there are periods where they're in, and then there are periods where they're out. Of course, women who worked as military nurses, there's always a small presence of those in the forces. But my research looked at the not military nurses, so servicewomen in other roles. So I started with that, and I did that at Carleton University. So it'll be kind of going back home to do the Shannon lectures, but I'm on the other side. So that will be a fun experience.
Yeah. So when you're talking about the types of roles that women were in, of course, I think, as you mentioned, most people would immediately go to nurses in the two world wars. That gets talked about, I would say, primarily when you're talking about women's roles during those two conflicts. But what other roles were women filling in the military apparatus? Because again, a lot of people have, I think, probably read about on the home front, going to into industrial work, that sort of thing. But specifically within the under the umbrella of the military, what sort of roles and tasks were women taking up?
Women were not in combat roles, right? So the entire period of my dissertation, women are not in the Canadian Forces, are not officially in combat roles with the Canadian Forces, right? So combat trades, any sort of the combat related trades are prohibited to women. They get access to those in the 80s and onwards. So women are, as Ruth Roach Pearson has said, they're the cooks and the clerks of the armed forces. So they get brought in to each of the branches, so the Army, the Navy, and Air Force, at different times. So in 1941, the Air Force is the first service to officially establish the women's branch. And the Army is quite right after that, and then the Navy follows in 1942. And so they are the orderlies, they are the clerical workers, they are the parachute packers, they are the cooks, they are all the different support staff that the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force needs to support those overseas doing the combat missions. So the trades over the course of the Second World War open for women. So as the war progresses and they need more and more manpower, and I use that term purposely. I mean, I like it sounds a little jarring to our modern ears, but they meant manpower, right? That I think speaks to sort of the very gendered attitudes that were prevalent at the time period and passwords. So as they needed more manpower, they enlisted women so that you could free up a man to fight, right? So that's sort of one of the rationales, we'll free up that. Plus, they also wanted to avoid the conscription crisis, like having another conscription crisis as in the First World War, which was very, very divisive. So women were seen as a better option than, you know, having a draft and conscription. But it did take until 1941 for women to get in, right? So women prior to that have formed their own paramilitary corps so that they could sort of do, and they would do different drills. I mean, each of these corps, and they were across Canada, varied in size, varied in what they did and what they taught, but they would do marching drill, they would do first aid, all that sort of stuff. So women had formed these and had been lobbying the government saying, hey, give us a role, let us serve, let us serve, let us serve, let us serve. And the government does, for various reasons, doesn't bring them in until 1941. And part of it, they wanted it so that they kind of could control women's labor a little bit better, right? So rather than having these paramilitary corps, you had them under the official forces, and then you could choose where to send and what roles they do, and send them where you needed. And you weren't giving sway to any one particular group. All groups can go into if they met the enlistment criteria to the forces. So women did a variety of kind of the staff work, the support roles, the mechanic work, some occupied as drivers. So a variety of roles, but not combat. Now, most of them served in Canada, and some were sent overseas. Now, they were stationed primarily in England, and then some groups kind of did some of the other European countries, depending on as the fighting sort of went on, like, you know, the fighting moved and the war was ending, you see them. But so bulk of them primarily served in Canada. Some had overseas posting in lovely Newfoundland, which wasn't part of the Defense Forces of Canada. Yeah. I always like that fact, right? So you get overseas posting and these are coveted and you're sent to Newfoundland.
Newfoundland, yeah.
Which wouldn't be, I think, what you were thinking of, or I would, if you put yourself back into those young women's shoes, wouldn't be what I would think you would want when you're wanting the overseas posting, right?
Yeah.
So they were, and about 50,000 of them served. So the numbers, again, are smaller. They're a percentage of the armed forces. But like the numbers they sort of try to limit the participation as much as possible. And by they, I mean the defense officials. So both like the government and military sort of negotiating these conditions.
So as we get past the Second World War into the Cold War period, you know, again, I think the record of women serving in the First World War in these capacities, in these non-combatant roles, is very good. You know, everything I've read and heard about is that, you know, women served with distinction and did their jobs and everything was great. So in the post-war period, once we get into this Cold War period, you're talking about the fight for their place within the veterans community, but also just continuing to serve in this era. So what was that like, that you have this record of service for women in these roles, and then in the post-war period, you know, that immediate like late 40s into the early 1950s, say around the Korean War, what is the discussion about the continued participation of women in this era?
So as the Second World War is coming to close, the three heads of the women's services, so that's what they were called. So they're the women's services of, so the Royal Canadian Air Force Women's Division, the Canadian Women's Army Corps, and the Women's Royal Canadian Naval Service, so the WRENS, as we often there. The heads of them all are writing reports, or contributing to the writing reports, saying, here's what we've learned over the last few years, and making the argument that we need to keep a small group of women employed so that if a future war breaks out, we can mobilize. So they make the argument that service women have unique needs as service women. So you have to both consider their needs as women, but also consider their needs as military personnel. And so only service women, so veterans would be in this case, but they would be still those with sort of experienced service women, have the requisite knowledge. Because when experience has shown, when you let men do it, and they often brought in women as advisors, but when you let sort of men do it, they didn't know what women needed as women. And if you let civilian women didn't know what the military needed. So you need this set of military, they're creating an argument for military women's expertise, right? So the women military experts are creating this sort of argument for it. So they write this report, they sort of sum up the problems, and in either explicitly or inexplicitly, they make this argument that you need to have these core group of women. So the military considers it, and the forces consider it, but in 1946, all of the women's services are disbanded. That's it. They're done. The only women that are retained are nursing sisters, and again, in a reduced roles, and a few women as dietitians, and other kind of small little roles that we don't sort of know, but the services are done and women are out. And when the Cold War sort of picks up, you kind of get different groups kind of recognizing, oh, we might need women back in because we might need to, grow the army and there's another war on the horizon. So you have veterans are lobbying, saying, hey, can we come back in? There's a place for women. And so some male veterans support this idea. You have random civilians writing in saying, I think we should have this. You have journalists sort of promoting the idea. But it is, it's a reoccurring idea, but it is a small idea. Because veterans themselves are also busy, right? So veterans after the Second World War, the literature shows, they had a lot of different responses. Like some joined Legion and other veterans groups. Some had nothing to do with them. They didn't want to do anything with them because they wanted to put the war behind them. They were busy setting up their own lives. They were busy grappling with what had happened. So there's three diverse groups, and women shared these experiences as well. So some joined the Legion, some and other veterans groups. Some women also set up veterans groups that pertain to their specific service. So you see an ex-CWAC group, so an ex-RENS groups and an ex, airwomen's groups. So all these sort of set up different veterans associations for their specific service. And so they set up their kind of own to create a community of veterans to support one another, because a lot of veterans argue that it's really hard to talk to other civilians about this, because only sort of a veteran is going to know what they went through.
Right.
And so these groups do a way to keep kind of these bonds. They also are a way to have fun, mutual support, a way to keep your close friendships alive. And so these groups are active in that period. And they also stay involved and sort of connected with the military itself. So over there, as the, you know, Cold War progresses, you see them kind of pass resolutions, say, hey, we should have women in the forces. You see them fundraise for the local base, the local effort to support. You see them have reunions, and a lot of them that will go and visit the local base or the local ship or the local Air Force station, right? And take a tour. So like they still keep their sort of connections, and they keep these sort of long bonds. So you have that sort of the veteran side. And then within it, in 1951, they kind of realized that, yeah, I think we need women back in the forces. And again, for various reasons, but again, the key idea is that we need a kind of a small group of women to expand. You also have the forces sort of rapidly expanding when Korea goes, and you have different technology needs. So in the 1950s, it's the Air Force that really has the largest need for women, service women, because we have the radars line set up, right? So they have kind of the largest need for this sort of technical manpower. But that also, the defense pilot argued, sort of fit ideas of women's ability to do monotonous work, because you're staring at radar screens, right? So the Air Force has kind of the biggest need. So in 1951, we get Defense Council approval that, yeah, we're going to recruit women. But this time they put like several conditions on it. So one, each service has what they call a total establishment, which is the maximum number of people they're allowed to recruit. And this time, a woman will count towards that. So you can recruit a man or you can recruit a woman, but it's all the same. That counts towards your total. So if you recruit a woman, that's one less man that you can recruit for the combat roles, because combat is not a job that women are allowed to do, right? Like, that's not a role. They argue that's, you know, there's no sort of question of whether women are going to get access to combat roles. It's just, no, this is a non-negotiable. We're not going to put women in combat roles. So you recruit a man or a woman, that means that's one less man that's then available to fight in a future war, right? And the Cold War is going on. So we don't know, or they don't know at this point, if anything is really, like, what's going to happen, right? Like, there could be, for all these people know, another world war, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't know, right? Like, in the time, like, we know looking back, but they don't know. So they sort of put that condition. Second, there's going to be no separate unit, women's unit. So women are then into the forces themselves. They're not a specific women's service unit that then sort of is attached to the force. They're integrated within. They're a part of the forces. So there's no separate women's unit that you're going to employ them. Basically, they're not going to take men's jobs. Like, you can't employ them if they're going to take a men's jobs. They're not going to be used, and also can't take a civilian woman's jobs. So there's a series of conditions on that Defense Council sets to sort of limit women's employment. But within that, then the Air Force recruits women, and it's the first one to recruit it into its regular forces, so the full-time forces. The other two start with women in their reserve forces, and then by 1955 you have them, women in the reserve and regular forces, so the part-time and the full-time forces of all three services.
Right. And you mentioned the idea that a woman would be good at monotonous work, that this is the perception that certain the people in authority had. How pervasive were stereotypes and gender stereotypes in the tasking that was assigned to women? The idea that women are good at this thing, so we are going to pigeonhole women into this task, whatever it may be. Like, how pervasive was that?
It was pretty abrasive, and it picked up in what was going on in the civilian world, right? So in the civilian world, if at this time, if you're going to be a woman professional, you're a nurse, you're a teacher, right? You're a clerical worker, right? There are few professional roles open to women. And so the same idea applies, that you're going to sort of trades where they felt was suitable or to women's abilities, right? So what the perception of what women, you know, traditional roles were. So again, you see a lot of them as clerical workers, right? Because there's a lot of civilian clerical workers. You see women as clerical workers. You see women as drivers. You see women do watch the radar screen, so fighter control operators. So some of them are actually very highly technical. But the idea of that we're going to associate women into these roles that women by nature are better suited or suitable to women's skill set, extremely, extremely pervasive. I mean, there are discussions. For example, in the Air Force, they have a discussion in their Air Force magazine said, you know, should women be allowed to fly? And you get a range of answers. So, like, some say no because, and they sort of catch on the stereotype of women being less rational, more emotional, right? Like, you couldn't put this emotional person in front of, in charge of an airplane, is the argument based on, like, the stereotypes of the time. Others say no, because women are going to take off to get married. So why train them in these expensive roles if they're just going to leave at some point to get married? Because that was the assumption, that the standard servicewoman across all the three services was going to serve for a short time before they started their ultimate career, as kind of the ideology at the time put it, of being a wife and a mother, right? So that's kind of like the stereotype, the norm, that, you know, women's ultimate desire is to be a wife and a mother, and they're only working until it's at the time that that happens. Of course, we know that, you know, women worked, and especially if you had sort of notions of class, race, ethnicity, you have a lot of group of women working. And women themselves also, you know, wanted to work, right? So you see some women accepting this. You see some women say, no, I want to stay in the forces, right? And you see this also, these sort of similar discussions in the civilian world, right? So this is when we sort of start getting ideas of equal pay. You start to see civilians sort of start getting, you know, no, you can't get fired when you become pregnant, right? We start seeing these legislations brought in the 50s, the 60s, and onwards. And so a similar thing kind of happens. So, like, initially when women are brought in the 50s, if you get married, you're out. And then mid-50s, they sort of change the rules saying, no, you can stay in if you're married, but if you get pregnant, you're gone. Like, right. that point. So both in civilian and military workforces, there is a broadening of women's place in the workforce. So you're not automatically, you know, kicked out if you're married or kicked out if you're pregnant. And that it sort of changes as the Cold War goes on.
Now, a lot of that, as you mentioned, there's legislation going on and or legislation being passed, and there are, you know, feminist movements of the 50s and 60s, right? These things are happening in the civilian world, but the military is quite different, and there are a lot of things that apply in civilian workplaces that don't apply in military workplaces. Where is the line here as it relates to protections on questions of sex and gender for women that exist maybe in the civilian world? Are there things that don't apply in the military environment, or things that the military just chooses to ignore?
It's in some ways it's sort of a question of yes and no. So the military at this point, and maybe it's sort of counterintuitive, actually paints itself as a more liberal employer than the civilian workforce. So they actually say, we're going to equal pay for work of equal value. Not in that language, but that's the thing. So you're going to get the same base pay, whether you're a woman or a man. So they, which at that point, once they were promoting it, didn't exist in the civilian workforce. I mean, it was coming. They also, for a lot of women, you get access to training that you wouldn't get in the civilian world. And so for in the 50s and 60s, I mean, the military represented an option for some women who didn't want to be pigeonholed into the, you know, the nursing, the teaching, the secretary work that was sort of very prevalent in Canadian society at the time. So in some ways, the military is a more liberal employer, but in other ways, it's very much a male-dominated institution at this time. It still was and arguably is a very masculine environment. I mean, we have the recent sexual scandals that sort of tell you that gender discrimination, sexual harassment are still ongoing issues in the Canadian Forces to this day. And that would have been true at this time period as well. So while, you know, your access to the sort of same pay, you're kicked out if you get pregnant or start a family, where men then would have access to benefits if they had for their families and spouses, which do not access to women, right? Also, if you're can't go into combat, that means then your promotion's capped. So a lot of senior positions, if you need combat experience in order to get them, right? Like, so like you're where, which that means you're, you know, your pay. Plus, women are also sort of fighting attitudes at this time over what women can do. There is sort of the constant need that you have to prove yourself to be, you know, capable of at doing these roles, right? So there are these military environment, you know, who think someone there, there's all sorts of sexual harassment and gender discrimination. We have the purge, the LGBTQ, LGBT purge happening at this time. So it's not an easy environment to be for women. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of these accounts. So women have largely sort of kept silent. So there are some accounts that kind of indicate, you know, that all the sort of types of, you know, comments on your appearance, the sexual innuendo, the harassment would have been having to constantly prove yourself that you, you know, you're as capable, if not more capable than men. Like, so you had to prove that, like, you were there, because, you know, the minute you don't, you're, the argument is, well, then why should women be there, right? So there is this sort of constant pressure to perform, the constant harassment, the constant being under a microscope. We don't have too many accounts, but accounts from later veterans who served in later period say the same thing. And based on sort of the attitudes that were pervasive in Canadian society at the time, I think it's safe to say that these attitudes were alive and well in the forces as well. So, And then the military also will, because it is distinct, you can send, you're expected to go where they serve, you're signing your, like, you will say, I will, you're signing your life, the limited liability, unlimited liability. That there are some ways where the sort of military say it doesn't apply to that. And we get that, with later when they're trying to, you get the royal status of royal commission on the status of women. There is a huge argument where the military like tries to say, okay, well, these don't apply to us because we're unique and we have to do combat and we have to see this thing. So you can only imagine, and the key argument in sort of defense planning here, so as women are sort of trying to, the senior women trying to kind of create more roles for women, sort of solve some of the discipline problems, open up saying, the idea is that, yeah, you can get employed as long as your job does not take away from a man's. Right. So you cannot disrupt the male career. So your posting is determined. Servicemen's careers are kind of first, and then you get posted in around as we need. So it's a complex kind of a fear in there.
Yeah. Is there a difference between, this is a lot of what you're, the area where you're studying is pre-unification. Yes. So do we see a difference between the elements, between the environments? So, you know, the Navy operates in a very different system, especially when you're deployed, than the Air Force or the Army does. So in this pre-unification era, do we see a fundamental difference between the three in the roles that women are taking or the way that they are treated?
There's similarities and there's differences. So each of the forces, each of the services will control their own policy under these general guidelines that the Defense Council and the Canadian federal government set, right? So they all operate under those general conditions. But they have different roles and different needs. So the Army keeps most of the women in the reserves. Because, again, things like Korea and there, most of the ones are in the reserve. The ones that are in the full-time forces are as corps advisors. So to sort of advise on the employment of women, they have a very, very small number of women. And as things are, like, the roles with them stay relatively consistent. Again, they're the cooks, the clerks, the support staff. But as we sort of get different postings, right, you get sort of more remote postings, then you get nursing assistants to sent there to look after the families of the servicewomen that are posted there. Mm-hmm. So some jobs open up, but they relatively stays relatively consistent. The Air Force goes up and then goes down. So like you get women in, you see sort of a couple of years, sort of a growth. Some of the jobs expand and they're doing key roles like meteorological observers, right? So you need weather personnel in order to fly, right? So these are important jobs. But as technology changes, these lines get closed and the numbers of women and the trades open to women decrease. And a similar thing, Navy is sort of smaller, like, so you get a little bit of expansion. And then there's they sort of, every few years, each service is negotiating whether we should employ women. Are women worth the cost? Because that's the reoccurring argument, that women, service women, are very costly employees because you were going to give them all this training and they're just going to leave,
right,
to get married. So there is an argument of, are women worth, as they would say, the return of service? Like, do we get a return on our investment or not? And every few years, they are debating. Each of these services are debating. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Is there? Should we keep? So they do. They do keep, but they always will put in different conditions that sort of restrict. So in the Navy, they restrict women to the East Coast. The West Coast was seen as more desirable posting. It was seen as kind of, they called it the yacht club, was a sort of a term with you. So it's kind of more fun. So yeah, when we'll keep you, but you're going to be on the less desirable East Coast rather than there. And then sort of they have these debates, the trades close, the numbers close, the amount of women, they put caps on women's recruitment service. So each service does, the time in which they do depends on which service. So there are differences as the each service has, as you said, is operating in a different environment, has different needs. But across all three services, it's a precarious situation, right? Like, there is never, if you're a servicewoman, there is this sort of constant question of whether are we going to keep them, right? That continues until 1965, 1966. When, as a part of the manpower studies leading to unification of the forces, they do want a woman, and they say, yeah, we're going to keep them. Several reasons, but we're going to keep them, and we need to stop asking this question. We're wasting time. Like, we've been asking this question for the last 20 so years. It's enough. And then they go on to whether combat is an option for women. That's their next kind of focus, and the integration of women into the forces, because you get in the 80s and 90s, you get human rights tribunals saying, yeah, you have to have gender equality, right? Like, that comes in, you get the charter, which then changes the kind of conversation. And that becomes kind of the focus after that. But in this period, it's Are women, do they have a place? It's never decided. And in 1964, the Air Force wants to phase out women. They say, okay, we're done. Let's go. And then there's a hold on, and then you get a question, well, yeah, we're going to keep them, because that's what the commission decides. But it's never, never a certainty over what to do. And so the policy goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down, goes up, goes this, sits, goes back. It's not a linear one. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned this, sort of the progression and then eventual discussions about women in combat roles, which eventually does happen. So for you, looking at this, and obviously we've just really covered the surface of what you study, which is why people need to go check out the book and come to the Shannon lecture. But what is the legacy of this era that you're studying? You know, I'm sure you have had the opportunity to speak with women in the forces today, and I'm sure women in the forces today have read your work and will probably be in the audience as well at the Shannon lecture. But for women and men, just service folks in general, what is the legacy of this era for you?
Well, I mean, for me, I think is that military service became a career choice for women. It was an option. And so for certain groups, you see there's some later interviews with some who say, okay, I was more of a tomboy, or I was more of an outdoorsy. I never, you know, school wasn't my thing. I didn't want to go into, you know, the jobs that were open for me. It represented an option that they didn't have. The forces would pay for your training, pays for your education. So this period made it possible for women who wanted to, they could pursue a career in the armed forces. So if you're drawn to it for whatever reason, whether it's your calling to protect defend Canada, to protect Canada, because for some women it is, whether it is a way to pay for your education, which is an option, whether it is, you know, a chance to travel, because travel is a big reason, you know, try something new, do something different. There's many reasons why women joined in the period I talk about and join now. It gave an option. And for those, as scholars have shown, for women who are part of the LGBTQ2IA community, it represented an option to way to support yourself, to form their own families outside of the heterosexual norms. I mean, that being said, that was for those groups, for those individuals, it was a precarious thing, because you have the purge, the scrutiny. If you were caught dating not a man, you're kicked out. You know, the intense scrutiny, the torture, the investigations. Other historians have covered by that self. But for groups who sort of, you know, don't fit the heterosocial norm, it does option a secure, stable employment. So the legacy that it does sort of create this as a option for women, that women do have a place in the forces. That being said, this place is kind of constantly challenged, and future generations kind of fight the same battles as these women. You have to prove yourself. You're negotiating there. You have to earn the respect. That being said, I will say that they do have diverse reactions, and servicewomen do talk about diverse reactions, that, you know, some of their male comrades would, you know, accept them. You know, you're a woman. Are you good at your job? Sure. Cool. All right. Like, they had... There are personnel who did see women as equal, did treat them as equal. And then there are other personnel who, you know, you're in operating in a very male dominated environment where you crack, you're the masculine warrior extreme, right? Like, that's sort of the idea. You're the manly man. This attitude sort of like combats where men sort of prove themselves to be men, right? That's this ideology. So you're still sort of faced with that, and that ideology persists for a long time to become. So women are still fighting sort of the same battles for years and decades after it. But it does mean that you do have the option. Like, women do have the option to be in the forces, which I think is a significant moment in Canadian women's military history and Canadian history that, yeah, if you wanted to, you could.
And that will be the subject of the Shannon Lecture Series, which is entitled Fighting for Their Place and Recognition, Canadian Servicewomen and Women Veterans in Post-Second World War Canada. That is Monday, this upcoming Monday, September the 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Dominion Chalmers Center. So if you're in the National Capital Region, be sure to come check it out. And if you're not in the National Capital Region, it is being recorded, I believe streamed live, and if not streamed live, will be available afterwards. You can also check out Sarah's chapter in Cold War Workers, which is a new book edited by Isabel Campbell, Cold War Workers, Labor, Family, and Community in a Nuclear State, which, of course, Sarah's chapter covers the role of military career women, the title of the chapter, Constructing the Military Career Woman, 1950s, 1960s. Lots of other great chapters in there, including discussions of Indigenous service members, Indigenous veterans, the Dew Line, service on the Dew Line as well. And so a lot of really great work in there. And it is edited by Isabel Campbell, who's one of the best in the country in military history. So Sarah, that's all the stuff that you got coming on straight away. But what else is going on for you? And what's the best way for people to keep up with everything you got going on?
So I have a couple. I'm also participating in the conference, In Their Own Voices conference at the Canadian War Museum that's coming up in October. So check out the Canadian War Museum's website for more information about that. And otherwise, you sort of can find me. I'm on LinkedIn, not very active there, but so you kind of come in and then so you keep your eyes on podcasts, on discussion and journals, and we'll see what comes from
and there. You're out there, yeah. So we will link to all that as well as the In Their Own Voices conference down in the show notes below. So be sure to check it all out. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was fun to get to discuss a subject I really love discussing. And I will add, please come to the Shannons, not just mine, but there's a wonderful whole Shannon lecture series on lots of wonderful diverse topics relating to the post 1945 forces in Canada. So please not just come to mine, but check out the rest of the lecture series. It's a great series that has been organized, and hope to see you there.
Yeah, it's a great lineup this year for sure, and you have the privilege of kicking it off. The leadoff hitter here of the 2025 Shannon. So very much looking forward to that again this upcoming Monday, September the 22nd at 7 p.m. Hope to see you all there. And again, Sarah, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So there you have it, my chat with Sarah Hogenberg, and I thank her for her time. And again, the Shannon Lecture Series, first one of the fall, will take place on Monday night, September the 22nd at 7 p.m. And I'll note that this is the first of our series where I will be talking with all of the people who are part of the 2025 Shannon Lecture Series. The theme this year is Revisiting Canadian Armed Forces Experiences. And it is being convened this year by Jean-Michel Turcotte, who's a historian at the Department of National Defense, as well as an adjunct professor in the Department of History at Carleton University. And the Shannon Lecture Series is an annual tradition put on by the Department of History at Carleton University, always on a theme of some sort, based usually on what the convener is interested in or studying. Last year, for instance, it was Black Histories and Futures of Science and Technology. 2023, Rewriting Refuge. Had one on climate histories, resource extraction, human rights in the history of Canada. So it's a wonderful series that's been going on for a long time, and would definitely encourage you to, if you're in the nation's capital, to join us on Monday night over at Dominion Chalmers. And if not, head on over to the Carleton University History Department YouTube channel, and you can find some past ones over there. So with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from The Lookout, Pacific Navy News, an article from
October 15, 2012, entitled Leading as a Woman in the Canadian Forces, written by Rear Admiral Jennifer Bennett, in which she profiles her experience as a woman in the Navy and her career rising through the ranks, joining in 1975, working up to the point of becoming a Rear Admiral. Some of the challenges she faced, in particular when she commissioned to become an officer, the challenges associated with that, how early on in her career, how ranks were different for men and women, how that was noted within the rank system. Also, how she wasn't allowed to stay on ships overnight during training exercises, and all of the challenges that she faced during her career, and how through the course of her career, things continued through the challenges and the efforts of women like her started to and increasingly got better for women. And you get the sense of that in talking with Sarah, that the women that she has studied, the efforts of women in the forces and veteran women continuing to try to ensure an environment in which all Canadians can serve and have the same opportunities. So it's a nice first-person account here of a high-ranking woman in the Canadian Armed Forces, a little older than what we usually have for the historical headline of the week, but a really wonderful first-person profile here. So I wanted to highlight that. So again, today's historical headline of the week from the Lookout, Pacific Navy News, Rear Admiral Jennifer Bennett from October 15, 2012, Leading as a Woman in the Canadian Forces. And with that, I'll say thank you so much, everybody, for listening. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab. And if you want to let me know what you would like to hear on the show, whatsoldestnews@gmail.com. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again real soon for more What's Old Is News.